This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Thank you for this wonderful honor. I'm really humbled and very grateful to be this year's recipient. And I'd like to just say a few things that I've written down, and then we'll go to the lecture. Curiosity and a deep commitment to learning and a willingness to explore the unknown are paramount to advancing science and society. The importance of an interdisciplinary community in addressing compelling scientific questions cannot be understated. It takes many talented, inquisitive individuals to advance knowledge. I've had the privilege and pleasure of working with many such talented students, fellows, staff scientists, and collaborators, and I accept this award on their behalf. They've had a shared belief that discoveries and innovation are born from caring, supportive, respectful, diverse, and trusting collaborative environments where we can say freely what we are thinking, to share ideas with one another, and at the same time, not to be afraid to say, I don't understand, so that we can learn together. In many ways, the type of environment they created and perpetuated in their support of one another illustrate the foundations for human flourishing: hope, trust, humility, empathy, kindness, generosity, gratitude, a shared sense of purpose, and a shared joy. How we as a lab traveled to the present moment was in so many respects unanticipated. The journey was full of unexpected events, observations, and interactions. It reflected finding the right partners, environment, and support system to first define and then pursue in a sustained manner questions that we found to be both alluring and daunting. The journey required the gift of attention, of sustained focus, a gift that ultimately only we could give to ourselves, a gift that allowed us to see and understand the significance of what lay in front of us and around us. Over the years, I've had the privilege of working with fantastic collaborators. These collaborations related to the gut microbiome began with the late Abigail Saliers from the University of Illinois and Tori Mitvet from the Karolinska Institute. My major collaborator, Tamid Ahmed, Executive Director of the International Center for Diarrheal Disease Research in Bangladesh, has, together with his team, dedicated their lives to understanding the origins in developing new ways to treat and ultimately prevent undernutrition in infants, children, and their mothers. I'd also like to point out Andre Osterman and Dmitry Rodinov in the audience here, who've been fantastic collaborators with us as we've explored this terra incognita together. Being able to see ourselves as a collection of interacting human and microbial, cellular, and genetic parts teaches us that we don't travel alone through life unaccompanied, that there is a profound microbial dimension to our biology and our health status. The dynamism of our microbial communities, their adaptability, the breadth of functions encoded in the microbiome that we've not had to acquire in our own human genome, the seemingly astronomical number of potential interactions between microbial community members and human hosts make the journey through this terra incognita both inspiring and daunting. The public is becoming increasingly aware of the microbiome. As such, there's a need to approach bench-to-bedside translation of discoveries mindfully, engage in a proactive societal dialogue about the ethical, legal, social, safety, and regulatory issues raised by this research. We're seeing how microbiome research will expand our understanding of the human condition, since in so many respects, the microbiome reflects the varied ways that we live. The very unsettling gradients in wealth and access to resources that currently exist, the health disparities that we must acknowledge, address, and surmount, as well as the existential threat posed by climate change. Witnessing global health challenges embraced by students in ways that reflect their passion, their creativity, and their commitment to innovation gives me hope for the future. We've learned a great deal during our journey. What remains to be discovered is what keeps me young. I truly believe that the work we have done makes it possible to begin to do all the things that we dreamed of. the best part of the journey is now and will be tomorrow. Thank you. So, let's begin the journey together. This is a shared journey, a journey that involved a number of generations of students in our group at Washington University in St. Louis, as well as several generations of very talented young investigators led by Tamida at the International Center for Diarrheal Disease Research. This is their story. I'm thrilled to be able to tell you about it. So childhood undernutrition is the major cause of death of children under five worldwide. It's not due to food insecurity alone. There have been a number of epidemiological studies that many factors operate within and across generations to affect not only disease risk, but also manifestations. Current therapies reduce mortality, fortunately, but they've had limited success in overcoming the long-term sequelae of undernutrition. That includes failed linear growth or stunting, immune dysfunction, including poor responses to vaccination, neurodevelopmental delays, and impaired cognition. So we're missing something about the mechanisms of disease, about pathogenesis. We're also missing a comprehensive definition of the biological state or states of undernutrition. So the World Health Organization has assembled a multinational cohort of healthy infants and children. The median value for height and weight at a given age has been defined. And undernutrition or growth faltering is defined by anthropometry as the number of standard deviations from the median value of this reference cohort. So let's take wasting. There are 40 million children in this world who have moderate acute wasting. Now, moderate acute wasting is defined as being 2 to 3 standard deviations below this median value of a weight for length or height score. We'll call that a WLZ score. There is no accepted treatment, standardized treatment, for moderate acute malnutrition. There are a number of nutritional interventions, but again, the long-term sequelae of moderate acute malnutrition, and by the way, a warning, I'm going to give you a lot of jargon, so we're going to call moderate acute malnutrition MAM. The sequelae are persistent and ineffectively overcome with current therapeutic intervention. Severe acute malnutrition, or SAM, affects 15 million children. And again, the treatment, although there is a protocol using ready-to-use therapeutic food, those interventions are typically stopped when SAM, defined as having a WLZ score, 3 standard deviations or worse from the median value, when children with SAM attain a level of weight and height that is equivalent to MAM. So these children have post-SAM MAM. But again, the long-term sequelae are not overcome with these interventions with ready-to-use therapeutic foods. Stunting, failed linear growth, is expressed as a length for age Z-score. So moderate stunting would be a LAZ score of -2 to -3, and severe stunting, a WLZ score of worse than 3 standard deviations. Now imagine defining cancer as moderate or severe. It's a very coarse definition. So we don't really know how to deal with stunting because all therapies are ineffective really at this point in time in overcoming stunting. We've only had very, very limited success with that. And we have the problem of the effects of current therapy being inadequate in terms of overcoming the problems associated with acute malnutrition or wasting. Now, I'm going to tell you about a hypothesis that we've been pursuing, and this work is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And the hypothesis has several parts, that there is a definable normal program of assembly of the gut microbial community. I'm going to call that collection of organisms a microbiota, and the collections of genes embedded in the genomes of these microbes, a microbiome. And the number of genes in our microbiome exceed the number of genes in our human genome by at least 100-fold. So there are many traits that we have acquired, not by putting the genes in our human genome, but rather by acquiring microbes that are master chemists and can do reactions, perform metabolism, that we are not capable of doing ourselves. So there is a normal program, we hypothesize, of assembly of this community that begins at birth. The disruption of this developmental process is causally related to undernutrition. And the corollary of all of this is that there is a elaborately choreographed program of co-development of our microbial community and our host organs and organ systems. So that's the hypothesis and the corollary, and I'm going to take you through the multi-step journey designed to test this hypothesis. First, we have to define normal in a population where the burden of disease is great. Then we're going to have to develop metrics for quantifying deviations from normal and determining whether those deviations correlate with the prevalence of disease and the severity of disease. Then we're going to have to do a test of causality, because if perturbations in microbial community development are associated with disease, is that association an effect of disease, or is that a causal contributor to disease? So that test of causality has to be performed. And then we have to identify if steps 1, 2, and 3 succeed, therapeutic targets. And given the fact that the burden of disease often occurs in low and middle income countries, the therapeutic intervention has to be culturally acceptable, affordable, and scalable. And we'll have to test those therapeutic leads in the very human populations from which we've done all the previous steps. So that's the multi-step journey. So we defined normal together with Tamid in a group of individuals living in an urban slum in Dhaka, Bangladesh. This is a birth cohort study. So children were enrolled actually as infants in the first month following birth, and monthly sampling of their fecal microbiota was performed. And anthropometry, the measurement of height and weight, was performed coincidentally at each time of collection of the microbiota sample. And this was performed for 24 months initially, monthly sampling, and then extended to 60 months. So Tamid Ahmed and his collaborators have long engaged with the community so that a trust has been established between the community and the healthcare providers. And the intention of the healthcare providers is understood by the community to be one of benefit to the community. And it's critical to do longitudinal studies in this field, because each person, she or he, represents their own best control. So with this background of community engagement, we were able to enroll infants in this birth cohort study, and the fecal samples and anthropometric data were analyzed. The fecal samples were analyzed by sequencing a gene that's represented in all bacteria that represents a barcode of life. We can classify bacterial life based on the sequence of this gene. It's called the 16S ribosomal RNA gene. And large data sets were accumulated from all these children. And the focus was on those children who escaped growth faltering. They had consistently normal anthropometry, WLZ scores, LAZ scores, throughout the period of time in which they were observed. And the DNA sequence data from these children was mined to identify who's there in the developing microbial community. And since the data sets were so large and the number of different species quite great, machine learning algorithms were applied to identify a group of age-discriminatory strains of bacteria, strains whose representation in the developing microbial community would change very distinctively as a function of time after birth. And the results of this type of analysis are shown in the so-called heat map. So every row of this heat map represents one of these age-discriminatory bacteria that was identified by a very talented MD-PhD student in the lab named Satish Subramanian. Each column in the heat map represents a monthly age bin. And we're going from 1 month all the way to 60 months. And the abundance of different organisms is shown in a color map, where red represents very abundant and blue represents not very abundant. And you can see in the lower left corner of this heat map a group of organisms that in this population of biologically unrelated children living in a common locale, this urban slum, were very prominent, and they became over time, as you move across the row, less represented, more diminutive in terms of the representation. Other organisms became more abundant later on. And if we took a vertical slice through this heat map and looked at the relative proportion of age-discriminatory bacterial taxa identified in this way, we could assign an age or state of maturation of the microbiota. Again, this is healthy. We could go even further, since organisms in this microbial community don't operate in isolation, but rather through interactions with other organisms, we could identify statistical networks of co-varying organisms and further reduce the number of organisms that we would use to define the normal assembly of the gut microbiota. And this was work done by Arjun Raman, and this statistical network of co-varying organisms he termed an ecogroup. And many of these organisms that were found in the developing microbial community of healthy children living in this urban slum in Dhaka, Bangladesh, were also represented in the developing microbial communities of children living in other low and middle income countries. So if we use these tools to define normal, we see that this community assembles largely over the course of the first 2 years of postnatal life. So 2 years to execute a substantial portion of this assembly process. And children with undernutrition had microbial communities that were perturbed. And these communities looked like children who chronologically were younger. So let me just rephrase that. A child who was at a particular age, who was malnourished, had a community that looked younger than that of their healthy counterparts. And this microbial community perturbation, this immaturity, was not repaired by current therapies for treating undernutrition, because none of these therapies were developed with knowledge of or a consideration of the developmental biology of the gut microbial community. So these children were left with a persistent developmental abnormality, these immature microbial communities. Was that immaturity that persisted even after treatment an effect of undernutrition or a cause of undernutrition? I'll also say that the degree of perturbation of the microbial community assembly process in children with undernutrition correlated with the severity of their disease, the perturbation being greater in those with more severe disease. So what are we going to do about this? We first have to do that test of causality. The test of causality consisted of taking very well-preserved microbial communities obtained from the children living in the locale where the burden of disease was great and where there was an infrastructure for doing clinical translational work, where we could test any therapeutic leads that we ultimately might identify in the very population that we did the initial sampling, and the very population whose microbes were introduced into preclinical models to do this test of causality. So that's a lot of words. Let me just reduce that even further to say it's possible to take well-preserved, i.e. samples that are frozen immediately after they were produced by children, microbial communities, and transplant them into the intestines of mice that were raised under sterile conditions. So these mice lived in these plastic isolators away from any environmental microbes, and no organ in their body, including their guts, had any microbes. But now they receive human microbial communities from children who either had normally maturing microbial communities that are healthy or had immature microbial communities and had undernutrition. The question is how many of the features of undernutrition could be transmitted to these recipient animals via their microbial community? How much of their you-ness was a reflection of the features of this collection of microbes? And in fact, compared to mice that received healthy donor microbial communities, those that received microbiota from undernourished children had growth faltering. Their rate of lean body mass gain was slower. They had bone biology that was perturbed. metabolism that was perturbed and immune function that was perturbed. All mice in all the treatment groups received the same diet, the diet that was representative of the very children that donated their microbial community. So we're able to recapitulate diet by microbiota interactions, and we're seeing that these communities from children with undernutrition could transmit features of growth faltering. Now that provided us an enormous opportunity because we had many mice for each child's microbiota. We had several different mice that received that community. We had many different children, each of the categories. We could apply machine learning algorithms and identify organisms whose representation in these mouse models correlated with the biological features that we were measuring. In this case, are there organisms whose representation was associated with musculoskeletal development or with metabolic functions or immune function? And these organisms we identified in this way were termed growth discriminatory organisms. These growth discriminatory organisms, in turn, were not appropriately represented in the microbial communities of the children that we actually began this journey studying their microbial community features. So children with undernutrition have microbial communities that could transmit features of undernutrition to these mouse models, and we could identify therapeutic targets. We can actually culture these growth discriminatory strains and add them to a immature microbiota from children with undernutrition before we put the community into these mice, and we saw that these growth discriminatory strains, when added, would ameliorate features of growth faltering. So further validation of their utility potentially as therapeutic targets. Now, we were funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and therefore we knew that we had to have a therapeutic lead that would be culturally acceptable, affordable, and scalable. These are anaerobes, organisms that don't like oxygen. If you write oxygen on a sheet of paper and show them to the organisms, they'll die. The idea of formulating a multi-species consortium as a next-generation probiotic that would have to be stored over time and then distributed to large populations wasn't technically feasible at the time, and the regulatory route for approval would be very complex. So in order to proceed, we considered the following strategy. There's a period of time between cessation of exclusive milk feeding and a fully weaned state that's called the period of complementary feeding. And every parent has to make a decision about what to feed their children as they are being weaned. Now, none of the policies for complementary feeding have been predicated on a consideration or knowledge of the developmental biology of the gut microbiota. So is it possible that certain complementary foods that are being fed in a region where the burden of disease is great could contain molecules, naturally occurring molecules, that could be coveted by these growth discriminatory strains that are so important for driving the healthy development of a child? And could we crack a code? Could we screen different foods in our mouse models that harbored microbial communities from the population of interest and see whether we could manipulate the fitness or express beneficial functions of these therapeutic targets in ways that could ultimately yield a collection, a formulation of these complementary foods that would be effective in repairing the microbial community perturbations of children with undernutrition. So we would have to screen complementary foods in a representative mouse model and to see if we could identify these microbiota-directed complementary food prototypes, which we would eventually test in the very populations that were used to create the preclinical models. So this is the strategy. It's a complicated slide, and all you have to do is start in the upper left-hand portion of the slide. So we cultured these age and growth discriminatory bacterial strains from the population of interest, these children living in Mirpur. We sequenced their genomes and took a collection of age and growth discriminatory strains and installed them in the intestines of these formerly sterile or germ-free animals. And then we started screening different complementary foods to determine whether they would hit their therapeutic targets and change the fitness of these organisms. we would find these complementary foods and we would pause and ask ourselves, are these foods available? Yes. Are they from sustainable sources? If they were, we would say yes. And did they have acceptable organoleptic properties? Now, how many people in the audience know what organoleptic means? A few people. Andre, you're not allowed to raise your hand. He's the spike in control. So organoleptic means taste, texture, smell. Taste, texture, and smell. And if you don't have satisfactory organoleptic properties, we could develop these combinations of microbiota-directed complementary foods, administer them to children, but these formulations would be rapidly ejected from the mouths of children into the lap of the parent or healthcare provider and have somewhat limited efficacy. So you have to think about these things early on in the discovery process. So a series of MDCF prototypes were identified in this fashion in mice that had collections, defined collections of these cultured organisms. We then went to a secondary screen and asked, do these lead microbiota-directed complementary foods repair intact uncultured communities that have been installed in these animals from children who had presented with undernutrition, had been given standard therapy, but are left with persistent defects in the configuration of the community? And we found a subset of our MDCFs, microbiota-directed complementary foods, that could repair these intact communities. Then we had to pause and say, we're trying to change the developmental biology of young children. Can we go directly from mice to humans? Or should we be more cautious and take a host species, not mice, whose physiology and metabolism was closer to that of humans, and test to see whether our lead MDCFs could repair microbial communities and have benefits to the physiology of this second species. The second species were notobiotic piglets. Piglets where we spent 2 years developing protocols to make sure that they remain germ-free in these isolators. We colonized them with these age and growth discriminatory strains from the very population that we ultimately wanted to treat and found lead MDCFs that not only repaired the microbiota, these piglets, but also changed physiology in ways that we thought would be beneficial to children. So then we advanced to the next step, which is to go back to the very community from which these microbes were obtained and do a pre-proof of concept pilot study, a controlled feeding study of MDCF prototypes in children with MAM, moderate acute malnutrition. We'll define MAM using anthropometry as a WLZ score of -2 to -3. There'll be a quiz at the end of this lecture, by the way. And we're going to do a short intervention. These children will be 12 to 18 months of age. ICDDRB set up a site within Mirpur in which mothers could come, and their children would be given one of four different formulations. Three MDCF prototypes coming from our preclinical development pipeline that involved mice and piglets, and one standard treatment that didn't really work very well. And the children would have a pre-treatment period in which we would collect fecal samples, do anthropometry, and just before treatment began, we collected a blood sample. And then there would be a four-week intervention, twice daily feeding of one of the different formulations in each arm. Again, only 15 children per arm. And weekly collection of fecal samples, after which time we would get another blood sample, and then 2 weeks of follow-up. Now, why was the blood sample so important? Remember what I said about the importance of having a more comprehensive definition of the biological state or states of undernutrition. If we were able to repair a microbial community, we could understand how that community's functions are linked to different aspects of physiology. How would repair, how would changes in components of the microbial community be linked, for instance, to changes in bone biology or metabolism or brain development? So we would want to know more comprehensively what the state of that child was. And the easiest way of doing that was to measure the levels of key mediators of different aspects of growth. These would be proteins that circulated in blood that affected many aspects of systems biology. A technology existed using DNA aptamers so that in 100 microliters of blood, just a small amount of blood, we could measure at the time 1,305 proteins that were biomarkers or mediators of all these different processes that underlay growth. So we could look at the effects of these interventions, not only on the microbial community structure, using those age and growth discriminatory strains, that eco group that I talked to you about earlier, but also by measuring the levels of these proteins. So from this type of work, a lead MDCF emerged, which we unimaginably called MDCF2. Okay, and the standard treatment, or the common treatment, was a ready-to-use supplementary food, RUSF. Now, let's take a look at these foods from the lenses of a nutritionist, not from the lenses of bacteria. So the formulation MDCF2 contains four complementary foods: chickpea flour, peanut flour, soybean flour, and green banana pulp. It also contains a source of lipids from soybean oil, and it had vitamins and minerals. The RUSF had none of these complementary foods. Rather, it had rice and lentils, and powdered skim milk, same source of lipids, same micronutrient premix, but and even in parentheses, exclamation point, the caloric density of the RUSF was 15% higher than MDCF2. So was this insanity on our part? Is this bodacious? Was this cunning? I don't know at this point in time. We did not know. But we're trying to improve the growth of children with something that is calorically less dense than standard therapy. So as a subtext or subtitle, should we be thinking beyond calories alone? And is there a contribution of the microbiota to the transformation of these formulations that's key to driving growth? So here's the proof of concept, randomized controlled clinical trial, a longer period of intervention, greater power, 60 children per arm, MDCF2 versus RUSF. I would be punny in saying it was a bake-off. And these children had MAM. They were 12 to 18 months of age. And the study was designed with a pretreatment period of observation of anthropometry and fecal microbiota. Periodic collections of fecal samples, anthropometry, blood at T equals zero just before we started treatment, 1 month into treatment, and at the end of the interval of 3 months. And then initially a 1 month follow-up, but we actually did something that was very important. We figured that we would have to study these children for much longer periods of time than 1 month, because we didn't know whether the response of the musculoskeletal system would be different in different ways over time. So we might observe, for instance, an increase in weight, but that may not occur coincidentally with a measurable improvement in height. Or perhaps CNS development would take a longer time to manifest as changed in this sort of experiment. So a two-year follow-up with every 6 month sampling of their microbiota and blood was also accumulated, or was also incorporated into our trial. So the primary outcome measure was going to be a change in WLZ. Secondary outcome measures was going to be microbiota repair and changes in the plasma proteome. In this case, we're going to measure 5,000 different proteins in a small drop of blood. So this is the first result we got, that the calorically less dense MDCF2 produced a greater rate of increase in WLZ compared to RUSF. That was a very interesting result. We didn't stop again in measuring WLZ or LAZ over time, but at the end of the 3 month intervention, we didn't see a significant difference in linear growth as judged by LAZ. We didn't see it after 3 months, but we're gonna go ahead and look at it over 2 years. And I'll tell you the result in a second. So then we said, okay, what aspects of systems biology are being affected? So we took each of the 5,000 different proteins, we being Robert Chen in this particular case, and tried to identify proteins whose levels were positively correlated with ponderal growth, with WLZ score. And we found 70 proteins that were positively correlated with WLZ. So we took all of the children in both arms, 120 arms, and for each child, we would look at the rate of change and levels of each of these 5,000 proteins and see whether there's a significant correlation with WLZ. And those 70 proteins were involved in mediating musculoskeletal and brain development. There were some proteins that were negatively correlated with WLZ, and those are involved in immunoinflammatory responses. And those children were treated with MDCF2 had a greater increase in these positively correlated proteins and a greater decrease in these negatively correlated proteins. So we're starting to see how the microbiota, at least after exposure to MDCF, was altering many aspects of biology, aspects of biology that operated beyond the walls of the gut. Now, during the two-year follow-up, even though there wasn't a statistically significant difference initially, at the end of the intervention of 3 months, there was an improvement in linear growth during the two-year period following the intervention. And in children living in low and middle-income countries, LAZ goes down over time compared to the reference cohort. The rate of decline of LAZ was much less in children treated with MDCF2. So there was an effect on weight gain, but also linear growth. And remember I said in the beginning, virtually no treatment for undernutrition has proven to be very robust for stunting. This implies that the effects of the three-month intervention, which is targeted to microbiota, was durable beyond the period of the intervention itself, and that we're affecting not only pondral growth, but also linear growth. So that was very encouraging. Now we have to delve into the mechanism further. So we're going to do something that's possible now. Sequencing is much less expensive, and we can take DNA from the fecal samples, and each child provided about 8 fecal samples during the course of the intervention. And we can fragment the DNA, sequence the DNA fragments, and reassemble the DNA into the genomes of the bacteria that exist in the community. These are called metagenome assembled genomes, and we could do that assembly process for all the fecal samples collected from a given individual and identify, jargon warning, these MAGs, metagenome assembled genomes. So we're able to look at the features of the genomes of these organisms that are present in the communities of these children that have been treated with one or the other treatments. And we can do that for each child, and then take all the MAGs from all the children and find MAGs that are common to all the children. Now, 1,000 such MAGs were identified in this way. And then we could take what's called linear mixed effects models to identify those MAGs, those bacterial strains, whose abundance is correlated with pondral growth, positively correlated with pondral growth. So we found 75 of these 1,000 MAGs were significantly positively correlated with WLZ score. And we turn to Andre and Dimitri and ask, what features in the genomes of these MAGs that were positively correlated were enriched in these MAGs compared to all other MAGs? They have the scheme for predicting the metabolic pathways encoded in the genomes of bacteria that's absolutely exquisite, incredibly powerful, accurate. It's called microbial community seed, and their metabolic reconstructions, initially they're over 100 metabolic pathways that they would use to annotate these MAGs with, there was very prominent enrichment of these positively correlated MAGs with pathways involved in utilization of various carbohydrates. So carbohydrate metabolic functions appear to be enriched in these bacterial strains whose representation in the communities of children being treated with MDCF2 were positively associated with growth. Okay, the enrichment of these pathways is one form of analysis. So just because the pathways are there in these MAGs that are positively correlated with growth doesn't mean they're expressed. So what was done was to take these samples and ask which pathways were expressed in response to treatment. So we perform gene expression analysis and ask which metabolic pathways are WLZ-correlated MAGs expressing when they're treated with MDCF2 versus RUSF. Now, I'm going to pause And Ajit Varkey, who's in this audience, is a magnificent glycobiologist. He studies complex carbohydrate structures and is termed people who love the field of studying carbohydrate structures have glycophilia. Now, most people who want to study carbohydrate structures are appalled at the complexity of the system and generally have glycophobia. So luckily, people in our group are glycophiles, and we also have an indicted co-conspirator, Carlito Librella at UC Davis. So the carbohydrate structures that are present in the components of MDCF2 and the components of RUSF were defined. These polysaccharide structures were then compared in one formulation, MDCF2 versus RUSF, and we found polysaccharides whose representation was enriched in MDCF2 compared to RUSF. I'm not going to go through these carbohydrate structures, but I will tell you, when microbes look at foods, they look at the chemical landscape of foods. They don't look at the label of foods. So this information was very important. And this is an overly complex slide, but I want you to look on the right side of the slide, and I'm going to give you the punchline. So we could look at gene expression in the fecal samples that were collected from these children prior to, during, and after the intervention. And we could look at those metabolic pathways whose expression was induced by one versus the other formulation. So the WLZ response correlated with expression of genes in those carbohydrate utilization pathways that were enriched in these mags, and the levels of microbial products of MDCF carbohydrate degradation were also correlated with the WLZ response. So by looking at the pathway for carbohydrate utilization and the actual products of carbohydrate metabolism, we were able to identify the bioactive components of MDCF2. And we were also able to see which organisms in this complex community were principally responsible for expressing the pathways involved in metabolizing these bioactive glycan components or carbohydrate components of MDCF2. And the astonishing thing was only a few strains in the community were responsible to be the primary degrader of these polysaccharides, and they both belong to a species called Prevotella copri. There were many different strains of Prevotella copri in these children's microbial communities. Only two of the strains appeared to mobilize expression of these pathways because they actually contain these pathways for carbohydrate degradation. Now, we're able to use the mags and these patterns of expression to culture the organisms that represented the responsive P. copri strains. These samples are extremely well preserved, so culturing is possible. And we had a search through the fecal samples to identify these correlates of the most responsive mags. And we employed these cultured representatives of these mags in the types of experiments shown here. So we could look at specific glycan components of polysaccharide components of MDCF2 to see if they stimulated the growth of these organisms and whether these organisms expressed the pathways that we saw in the more complex community. This exercise of looking at mags assembled by DNA sequencing, followed by culturing the organisms that seem to be most responsive, followed by understanding the code by which they recognize and utilize carbohydrates was very important. It's very important for prebiotic discovery, because creating a food like MDCF2, making it at a scale that's necessary distributed across many countries, is a very significant logistical problem. If we're able to get prebiotics from, for instance, the byproduct streams of food manufacturing, that is to say, these glycan structures that were used by the microbes, we'll term them prebiotics, we could think about in the future of having sprinkles of prebiotic mixtures of these bioactive components added to a variety of different diets. Anyway, ultimately, we have these correlations between the bioactive components of MDCF2, the organisms that use them. We would really like to see whether these P. copy strains are key drivers of growth. So we did an experiment called the reverse translation experiment. We cultured the age and growth discriminatory strains that correspond to the mags that we identified in the ways I've talked to you about. And then we took female mice that had been reared under sterile conditions that had just been given, they had just given birth to a litter of pups. And we did a successive round of colonization. So we took early colonizers of the human gut. We take somewhat later colonizers of the human gut, and then even further later colonizers of the human gut, and serially gavage the intestines of these mothers with these collections of cultured genome sequence organisms. They transmitted the organisms to their pups, so we're able to reenact the assembly of the microbiota that normally occurs in these children. The pups were given a sequence of diet that resembled that of the children in the study that we had just performed. We were able to reenact that. So they started out with breast milk in the female mouse, then a weaning diet that was consumed by the study participants, and then they were switched when they were weaned to MDCF2. The thing that separated the two groups of animals in this study was that one group received all of these organisms that we had cultured. Another group received all the organisms except for P. copri. We asked, what happened when these pups received a community that lacked P. copri or contained P. copri? When you had P. copri, there was significantly greater weight gain, there was markedly greater efficiency in the processing of glycans, and a huge effect on metabolism in the host, particularly in the lining cells of the gut. I think I'm going to run out of time and your patience, so I'm going to tell you two other things before we end up. This idea of being able to reenact the assembly process of a microbial community in pups born others and to give them a diet sequence that resembles that of children in the clinical trial enables us to start cracking a code about metabolism, what the organisms in these communities actually do metabolically. And I'm going to give you a brief vignette about such an experiment. It'll be described in an article that's coming out in Science next week or in a week and a half. There's a enzyme that we humans make called fatty acid amide hydrolase, or FA. It's important in regulating the metabolism of endocannabinoids, a group of molecules that have important physiological functions, including regulation of appetite, mood, memory, and pain. Oleal ethanolamine and palmitoyl ethanolamine are representative of a class of these molecules. Together, they're called N-acyl ethanolamines. It turns out that a key age and growth discriminatory strain in the community of these children of a species called Picalobacterium prysnitzii contains a bacterial equivalent or orthologue of the human enzyme. So Picalobacterium prysnitzii has a FA. We identified this organism's capacity to make FA by creating communities in these mice that did or did not have F. prysnitzii and saw that there was a marked effect on the level of OEA and PEA. The bacterial enzyme looks different than the human enzyme in a number of important features. It's not inhibited by inhibitors of the human enzyme. It has an incredibly broad capacity to synthesize molecules. This was tested in a series of in vitro reactions using a variety of amino acids and other substrates, a variety of fatty acids. We were able to identify the major synthetic products. Some of the major products produced by this bacterial enzyme, when added to mice, had a huge effect on their immune system, dampening immune responses. The enzyme not only can build molecules, but can break them down. It has broad hydrolytic activity, and its activity includes the capacity to hydrolyze a number of compounds that have effect on neuronal function, acylated forms of GABA and serotonin. It also is able to break down molecules produced by bacteria that are essential for causing disease in the case of certain bacteria termed pathogens. So these are quorum-sensing molecules. When we turned to the study of children who had received MDCF2 and looked at the levels of the products of this bacterial enzyme, we saw using mass spectrometry that fecal samples collected before and after 3 months of treatment of children with primary MAM, in the case of those treated with MDCF2, levels of OEA were significantly reduced. That's not the case with RUSF. That among all of the MAGs that were present, the only one whose abundance correlated with levels of OEA was an F. prednisii strain. If we looked at expression of FA, this bacterial enzyme, by this organism, F. prednisii, the expression correlated with levels of OEA. And the implications are the significant reduction in this oleoethanolamine, which is a satiety factor associated with MDCF2 treatment, offers a potential benefit of this form of treatment in undernourished children. Because if you are able to reduce the level of satiety factor, you would increase appetite, and that would be a beneficial effect. But this enzyme really has the capacity to do much more than our human enzyme in terms of its synthetic and degradative properties, and illustrates how you can park an enzyme in different organisms that has effects, slightly different effects, and the capacity to perhaps manipulate the representation of the bacterial FA would produce a number of beneficial effects that need to be explored. So we need to determine the generalizability of treatment of undernourished children with MDCF. We have to test in other populations. Age is an important variable. Remember, the central hypothesis is co-development of the microbiome in the host is linked to healthy growth. So you have to define how malleable the system is. Would the biological response to MDCF2 be affected by the time of initiation of the disruption of community assembly? Would the effects of disruption earlier postnatal life compared to later in postnatal life be more devastating to host biology and your capacity to repair the system? How about the duration and severity of the disruption and its the degree to respond to our treatment? And the importance of looking at the chronology of responses, because a weight gain response may take a shorter period of time to manifest than a linear growth response or neurodevelopmental response. So we've tested MDCF2 in a paper that came out just a week ago where we took children with post-SAM MAM. Remember that? Children with severe malnutrition, treated with standard therapy, they're parked after this treatment with MAM, and then took those children and asked whether they respond to MDCF2 compared to RUSF in a way that was similar to children who had no history of SAM. They came in with MAM, primary MAM. And the answer was yes. The responses were the same. So children who began with more severe disease and ended up with MAM could respond to MDCF2. If you take a look at the plasma proteome of these children sampled over time, over a 2-year period of time, you can identify proteins that are correlated with linear growth response. And the interesting thing is that these LSD-associated proteins are involved in musculoskeletal development, energy metabolism, but also brain development. There's a link between stunting and brain development. We see that, that's been shown by epidemiologic studies, we see that portrayed in terms of the response to microbiome repair in these types of studies. And you can see from this slide, and there's no quiz on this, that many, many different aspects of musculoskeletal development are affected. The proteins are involved in bone mineralization, matrix formation, bone remodeling. They're also involved in energy metabolism, but also various aspects of CNS development. There's a large study called NutriMAM that's looking at MDCF2 in a number of countries beyond Bangladesh, India, Mali, Pakistan, and Tanzania, and 3-month intervention with MDCF2 versus RUSF versus locally available food, and then a 3-month follow-up with mechanistic studies of the type that we talked about. And this study is being sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, WHO, and UNICEF. So we'll be able to test the generalizability of this treatment. Clinical studies of this type need to have mechanistic studies because we eventually want to identify biomarkers for stratifying disease populations, better metrics to evaluate the efficiency or efficacy of response to treatment, better definitions of wellness, and ultimately new ways of defining policies for complementary feeding practices. Last bit of data that I want to show you is that we've been talking about the fecal microbiota. There's a long tube called the gut, about 10 meters long. There's a small intestinal microbiota. Peace Corps workers in the 60s were coming back in some cases with malnutrition and malabsorption. They were endoscoped, and their gut mucosa was looked at under the microscope. And they had a patchy pathology that affected their small intestine, in which they would lose the absorptive area of the small intestine. Small intestines have villi, finger-like projections, overlain by an epithelium. These Peace Corps workers had a collapse of their villi. The epithelium was disrupted, so they had barrier dysfunction. There was inflammation in their gut. This villus atrophy, loss of absorptive surface area, the immune infiltration was startling. And the question that we asked together with our colleagues at ICDDRB is whether children with undernutrition have the same pathology and whether the microbiota contributes to it. There was an endoscopy study done of children with malnutrition who failed standard therapy. A significant number of these children, a majority of them, had this enteropathy called environmental enteric dysfunction, cultured the microbes from their small intestine and introduced those into our mouse models, and that collection of microbes produce enteropathy and systemic inflammation and impaired many aspects of growth. You could transmit that collection from a female mouse to the pups and get intergenerational transmission of these pathologies. And undernutrition is an intergenerational problem, where the majority of microbes in our gut come from our mothers. If we take females living in DACA who have malnutrition and do endoscopy, we see the same pathology. We can culture the microbes from their small intestine. We can also, in this case, unlike children, do endoscopy on healthy women who come into GI clinics for other problems. And we see they don't have the enteropathy. Their culture collections don't produce enteropathy, as opposed to their counterparts who have undernutrition. So a lot of work is being done to see how the small intestinal microbiota contributes to undernutrition. And the final thing I'd like to say is that one embodiment of a microbiome project involves the establishment of human microbial observatories at sites in selected low and middle income countries, where long-term sampling of microbial ecology in the population can be conducted. And I think this is going to be extremely important. The world is changing very rapidly. Disease patterns are changing. The environment in which people live are changing. So it's going to be very important to establish a program where sites are selected based on the fact that the population exemplifies a global health challenge or challenges of interest. The anthropologic features of the populations are predicted to change over time. The environments in which they live are predicted to change over time. And we want to try to correlate changes in the environment and the way people live with their microbial ecology. It's important, if you have these microbial observatory programs, to have engagement and trust on the part of the population. That level of trust is critical for longitudinal studies and also for the fact that we can follow individuals not only for the first couple of years of postnatal life, but also an extended period of time thereafter. It's also important, if you set up such observatory programs, to have deep knowledge about governmental regulatory policies and how they affect microbiome research. That relates to sharing of biospecimens and metadata to avoid biopiracy, how they consider prebiotics, probiotics, or combinations of the two, symbiotics, to be worthy of approval for use. How about sourcing approval and distribution of microbiome-directed therapeutic foods? Best practices and policies for ethical informed consent that includes issues related to ownership of microbes, future use provisions. That's very important, I think, as we conduct this area of research. We also have to think about equitable and realistic policies for economic benefit to local industry. That's stewardship of IP and working closely with governmental agency. You have to be able to figure out how to best archive samples and a strategy for prioritizing their evaluation. And these are decadal programs, and the funding of these types of programs is going to be very challenging, but also very important. So thank you for your attention. This is a story of a remarkable group of people who have been pursuing this problem for quite some time. And I just would like to thank you for your attention to what they have been doing and what we would like to do. Thank you.
So we're really sort of looking at this at the point of view of sort of subtracting. You know, we almost have a disease that's forcing us to learn about the microbiome. But there must actually be sort of a cosmology of the biome in the sense that we must have co-evolved with these things, and maybe there were some very fortuitous accidents. I mean, is this, am I even like thinking about this the right way? I don't know what my question is so much as
answers, by the way, not questions.
There must be a study of how we co-evolved, and you know, maybe we wouldn't look like we are now if the microbiome was different, or we didn't have certain aspects of it, or maybe we'd all be very short.
It's remarkable the robustness of the system to be able to assemble a multi-species, multi-strain consortium of microbes into a functional unit that has so many pivotal roles in postnatal development and even beyond. Requires a set of rules that operate to drive evolution of a community. Now, there is predation that's occurring. Things that we're doing now, at this stage of human evolution, in terms of our anthropology, the anthropology of food, the use of antibiotics, are perturbing the diversity of our microbial communities. There's a lot of functional redundancy in these communities. There are many different strains representing a particular species. It's important to have a diverse community so that it could withstand perturbations and would have resiliency. Now, as to the evolution of functions distributed over different microbial lineages and how that came to be, how much horizontal gene transfer makes each of a microbial community an ongoing experiment, how we can learn lessons about the niches or jobs of different strains so that we could use them as next generation probiotics to do ecological repair when the system is so disrupted that it's going to be harder to repair them with just food-based intervention. These represent the issue of strain level variation, and its significance is a huge one. It is important when we think about our biology, and this is the sort of major point of this lecture, is to think about the enormous effects of these microbial communities on so many different aspects of our biology. But that's life on the planet Earth. The microbes came first. As eukaryotes developed, they encountered microbes. They had to make a pivotal decision, quote unquote, many hundreds of millions of years ago about how much of the functionality that microbes have at their disposal should be incorporated into eukaryotic genomes and how much we could basically park those capabilities into a gut. So it's a wonderment. It's an incredibly complex system, considering the combinatorial number of interactions that might occur, but the system is sublime, elegant, very robust, and we have to be able to figure things out about its workings in order to harness the microbiome in order to improve health. That's therapeutic as well as prevention. I think this constellation of disorders called undernutrition represents one case in which we can start examining or approaching these perturbations and solutions to repairing the perturbation.
Thanks. That was amazing. So much to think about. Can you say anything about the global or untargeted metabolomes in your cohorts? And could those be predictive of either age or disease state in a manner similar to you're doing with the microbiota?
In principle, the same approach can be used to serially sample the metabolome, whether that's the plasma metabolome, fecal metabolome, and try to get age discriminatory metabolic signatures. growth discriminatory signatures. I think that that's going to be very important. The samples have to be well preserved, and the complexity of the metabolic landscape is enormous. And if you use non-targeted mass spectrometry, there's going to be the problem of being able to quantify the levels of these metabolites accurately and to identify what the MOVZs are. I think one of the approaches, and this is something that you've thought about a lot, is whether to grab the metabolites themselves and to do that sort of exercise, whether to try to predict metabolites based on gene expression profiles from these communities. We have these large microbial RNA sequencing data sets that tell us about the metatranscriptome to see whether the products of certain metabolic pathways are likely correlated or are in fact correlated with certain features of growth or certain features in the plasma proteome, and to look in a targeted way at those metabolites. I think the last point I would like to make is, I went through this very quickly, but if you took these models, these mouse models, where we take defined communities, for instance, of organisms from a population of interest that are correlated with different aspects of growth, and start doing leave-one-out experiments. So you have an intact community, so to speak, a community that lacks an organism, and start doing metabolomics on the intestinal contents of these animals. We start discovering how certain organisms, in fact, are correlated with the biochemical activities that determine whether a metabolite X or Y is present in higher or lower concentration. And that led, in this particular exemplary case, the discovery of a growth discriminatory organism that had an enzyme that looked like the human counterpart, but in fact had widely more diverse functionality, both synthetically and in terms of hydrolytic activity. And a whole world of metabolites is seen, both in terms of synthesis, but also in regulating the degradation of other metabolites that might be produced by the human host. So that's also a discovery arm. The beauty of that is that you have a naturally occurring organism that has evolved to be fit in the gut, whose representation, in the form of a particular strain, could be affected in a probiotic delivery way and really change lots of metabolism, or to be able to correlate the representation of that particular strain and deliberately feed the host harboring that strain with substrates in the form of food to produce these sorts of bioactive compounds. So there are lots of strategies that can be employed from these different approaches.
So basically, I wanted to know a simple question. It looked like what one of your slides said was, is that if we eat green bananas, peanuts, soy, and
chickpeas,
we would be advised to eat these things. Everyone in this room would be advised to consume these things. Is that, did I read that right? Or
that's an extrapolation from what I said. What I'm saying is that this is a formulation that contains bioactive glycans that could repair the microbiota of children as that community forms. Okay? The generalizability of that response of microbiota repair and changes in system physiology is being investigated in several other different countries. And that is being investigated in children that are 6 to 24 months of age. I didn't emphasize that enough because we didn't have enough time. Most of our studies have been in the second year of postnatal life. So whether this generalizes to a broader age range is going to be important to determine. I think that the other part of your question is that once repair is induced, how long can it be sustained? And do you have to give, it would be like chemotherapy, if you induce a remission, do you have to give maintenance therapy? So part of our capacity to do long-term studies allows us to determine in a very systematic way whether dosing at different intervals after the initial intervention will produce host effects that are more beneficial than children who don't get that boost. And that's the value of having the plasma proteome defined in the way that I described and spending all these efforts to identify growth discriminatory plasma proteins that correlate in terms of their levels or growth promoting protein that correlate in their levels with actual treatment. Point of care diagnostics is going to be very important if we're ever to do adaptive clinical trials. Better ways of evaluating efficacy, critical.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.